Good afternoon. I see there's a bunch of people standing in the back, and there's some open seats around the room. So if we could do the usual thing and kind of slide everybody towards the outside, then we can fill in some of these extra places. And while you're doing that, I'll introduce myself. My name is Len Wyatt. I'm a program manager in the SQL Server product group back in Redmond. And I have no koalas. I'm not going to be bombarding anybody during this talk. I could have some if I need them. But for those of you who are here in the last session, no animals will be flying around the room this session. But hopefully we'll have some good information flying around the room. Okay, this is interesting. This screen is not, this is going to be interesting, folks. I'm not quite understanding the new AV setup here. So what we're going to talk about today is big data. And I'm not here to sell anything or promote anything particularly. The goal of this session is just to kind of explain from a few different perspectives what big data is all about. You know, why we're interested in big data, what this Hadoop ecosystem is all about, and to use what you know about RDBMS environments to relate that to this new ecosystem that's starting to evolve. So that's really what this session's about. It's purely educational. Why all the fuss about big data? You've heard, I mean, everybody's heard this, right? This explosion of data. There's new data all the time. And I think there's really two things that we need to think about this big data. One is that there is more data, even of the type of data that we've already been working with. Data that you might think of as data that could be relational. It's tabular in format, or at least it's regular in format. So, you know, we've got sensor data that comes from all over the place these days. Utility companies have automatic metering of meter readers on houses and businesses. And they get data all the time. It's just flooding in. It's a stream of data that's huge. It's just huge. And even though we could use our standard relational techniques with this data, we might think about other techniques just because of the sheer data volume. Now, the other thing that comes into play in the big data space is what I think of as the opportunity to use entirely new data types. Right? We've got image data. We've got unstructured data of all kinds of different formats. So data that wouldn't have fit in our relational structures at all can be analyzed and worked with in these big data systems. So those are the two main drivers, I think. You know, the new incredible number of data sources that come from sensors and machines and automatic generation of data, and then the new types of data, drive us to be interested in some new ways of doing things. Now, in theory, there's a lot of ways to deal with big data. There's a lot of tool sets you might bring to bear on big data. In practice, most of what's happening in the marketplace these days, among all the different vendors and in the open source community, most of it revolves around Hadoop. Hadoop is a product of the open source community. It originally was written in Java, and that is it still is written in Java, actually. And as a number of different vendors are bringing products to the market, they're all mostly in the Hadoop ecosystem. And Microsoft's offerings are as well. We fit in the Hadoop ecosystem, and I'll talk a little bit about that later. But this is a rapidly evolving ecosystem. The whole thing is only a few years old. This stuff evolved out of the social media companies, Yahoo and Facebook and Google. Those are the kinds of places where these tools originated. But many vendors are rushing into the space. There's a lot of activity in terms of new developments. There's new tooling on top of the Hadoop ecosystem. So there's a lot of change. You really have to go into this space with an open mind and realize it's going to be a continual learning process to work in big data. All right, so let's start kind of at the ground level and ask ourselves, what is Hadoop from a structural point of view? What's Hadoop made of? And fundamentally, it's got two pieces. The Hadoop core consists of the Hadoop Distributed File System, HDFS, and an algorithmic piece called MapReduce. So let's talk first about HDFS. So it is a distributed file system. If I imagine having a gigantic file, this file is broken up in the file system into chunks. We'll just call them chunks. And you can imagine these different colored squares as being different chunks of the file. They're 128 megabytes in size. And any given chunk is going to be distributed out to multiple nodes in the distributed cluster. So the machinery that's running a Hadoop system is a cluster of nodes. And there may be, you know, a handful of nodes, or there may be thousands of nodes in the cluster, depending on how much data you're trying to store. But any given block of the file will be stored on multiple different physical nodes. So the yellow block will be stored on three different nodes. So different physical servers will hold that block. And then the next block, the black one up there, you can see that gets stored on a different three physical servers. This has got there's two important reasons why this is done this way. One is for parallelism, right? When the blocks of the file are distributed over a whole bunch of machines, then when you've got work to do on the data, you can be doing that work in parallel on all the different machines in your cluster. And the reason for the three copies of the data is for reliability purposes. If any one of those nodes fails, there's two other copies of the data that will keep on running. And so one thing that you'll find about the machinery that people deploy Hadoop clusters on is that it's sometimes not the same class of machinery that you're used to thinking of for deploying, say, a relational database. These are not the top-of-the-line servers with RAID disks or mirrored disks and things like that. These are generally fairly cheap servers with big disks, and the idea is just to create a lot of storage cheap. And if something fails out there, so what? At the software level, we've got redundancy built into the system, and if a server goes down, the master node, the name node, will look at that and realize that it now doesn't have three copies of everything anymore. You'll start to replicate to other machines, so it gets back into a stable state of having three copies, and things will continue on. So there's a lot of reliability is inherently built into this system. And when I say three copies, that's the default for a Hadoop system, but that's a parameter. You know, any given site can set the number of copies that it wants. So that's the first thing that you'll see as part of the core of Hadoop is the Hadoop distributed file system.
Can the name node go down?
Generally, that's a great question. Can the name node go down? That's a bad idea right now to have your name node go down. So generally, if there is one piece of equipment that people do put in, you know, for example, mirrored disks and things like that, and that would be the name node. There are techniques for backing up the name node and things like that. And I will say that when Microsoft's offering comes out, you can expect some additional functionality in terms of protecting your name node that isn't normally part of Hadoop today. But that is a great question. The name node is, in fact, very critical to the operation of the cluster. The other key piece of Hadoop is called MapReduce. And this is a programming paradigm. It's about algorithms. And the idea behind MapReduce is that you want to take a big problem and divide it up into lots of little problems. And you may have heard this notion of sending the execution to where the data is instead of bringing the data into the central CPU. And that's really what this whole idea is about. The system will divide the work up according to the chunks of data that are on each of the nodes. And if you've got a big problem, it will distribute that out and it'll say, you know, node one, you run on this chunk of data. Node two, you run on that chunk of data. And those are the chunks of data that are on those nodes already. So the data doesn't move around the network and get passed from node to node. The data in the map phase is handled right on the node where the data resides. But that only gets us partway through executing an algorithm, because the second thing that we've got to do is take all those partial results and put them together. And that's what's known as the reduce phase in the map reduce paradigm. And in the reduce phase, there is this shuffle that happens to get data to the right reducers. And reducers run on different nodes in the cluster. And you've got data that was produced by the map phase on various nodes in the cluster. In the shuffle, the data gets sent to the right reducers. The reducers aggregate up the result set and produce the final output of the map reduce job. This is a little bit of MapReduce code. It's written in Java. And I'm actually not going to spend any real significant time on this. It's just kind of an illustration. The programmer writes a map class and a reduce class. And it provides those two classes to the MapReduce framework and kicks off this job. Now, in this example, it's a kind of a trivial example. Given a pile of text, we want to know what is the word count of different words in the text? So how many times did the appear in the text compared to Kulangala? So the mapper will go through the text and it'll break the text into individual words. And it will output that word and a value 1. And that's the output of the mapper. That gets provided to the reducer, and the reducer's job is to match up all the like words and add the number of ones that were there with those words. So the word becomes the key, and the one is the value that's being aggregated. That stuff gets rolled up, and when the reducers are done, then you've got the complete count of the number of times each word appeared in your text. Now, most of us are IT folks, though. Most of us are not developers, and I don't want to write MapReduce jobs. I don't know about the rest of you. That's not my cup of tea. And the good news is that I don't have to. There's a whole ecosystem that's built on top of this idea of MapReduce and HDFS. And there are tools that do jobs that we will start to recognize as seeming kind of familiar. There are tools for moving data around. There's tools called Flume and Scoop that move data from file systems or from relational databases. There are tools for data integration. There's a query tool, the Hive query language, which we'll look at more, which lets us write queries in a language that's remarkably like SQL. There's another language called Pig, which lets us do set-based operations on data. And we'll look at some pig examples in this session. There's a whole bunch of things, workflow management. There's a metadata service, various monitoring services. These are functions that you should all be familiar with. These are things we have to do today. And guess what? We still have to somehow do those things, even in this new ecosystem. So we've talked a little bit about HDFS already. I'm going to talk about Hive and Pig today. Part of this menagerie of interesting names that come with the Hadoop ecosystem. There's other parts of the system, too. Scoop is a tool for moving data between the HDFS system and relational databases. HCatalog is a fairly recent tool that provides metadata services for Hive and Pig. HBase is a NoSQL database. And we'll talk a little bit more about NoSQL in a minute. Uzi for workflow management, Foom for data ingestion, and the list goes on. This is an incredible list of names of tools. And at first, it seems kind of intimidating. You know, there's all these names that we're not familiar with, and they sound really exotic and everything. But if you think about the number of different names and tools that we deal with already in our current environments, right, we've got databases, we've got ETL tools, right? We've got things like analysis services, and we've got front-end tools, and we've got data management tools. And so we have our own menagerie of things. They just don't have such colorful names. So we shouldn't think that this is necessarily a more complicated ecosystem. It's different, but I don't think it's actually more complicated than what we work with today. So now it's demo time. And I have good news and bad news about the demo. The bad news is that the demo is broken. It doesn't work. And it turns out it's my own fault. I took a new build of the bits too soon before I left on the trip. I thought it'd just be take the new build, put my data back in, and I'd have everything up and running again. Turns out it wasn't that way. Something was broken that I could not get fixed in time. And that seems really bad. That's terrible. I can't do the demo. But there's good news. And the good news is that several years ago, my laptop failed 10 minutes before I was supposed to go on stage and give a demo. And I learned to always go with screenshots of what would have been in the demo. So I'm going to do a screenshot walkthrough of the demo. And I apologize, it isn't going to be live, but it's what we can do. Okay. Now, despite everything that I said about HDFS being the underlying layer of Hadoop, it turns out that there's actually an abstraction layer there that lets us abstract out the storage layer. And I'm going to show a demo that runs in the cloud instead of on an on-premises cluster. So everything I said is actually true, and that's how you would build an on-premises cluster. But if you want to operate in the cloud, it turns out it's actually a better idea to store your data in cloud storage, like Azure File Azure Storage Vault, ASV volumes. And the reason for that is you can store your data in ASV storage, and then you can only instantiate your Hadoop cluster when you need to run something. So you don't have to pay to keep your Hadoop cluster around when you're not using it. But the data is still there, securely stored in ASV volumes. And there's an abstraction layer in Hadoop that lets you use either kind of storage. And in this demo, I'm going to show us using ASV storage in the cloud. In order to do that, I have to have a place to store the data. And so if I go to Windows Azure, this is the management screen that I would see, or this is one of the screens I might see. And this is where I've got my storage accounts. And the one that's highlighted in the middle there, I've got a bunch of movie data. A company that sells movies, they've got customers, and they've got titles, and they've got a table of sales and things like that. So that's where I'm going to store this data, is in my cloud storage account. Now, there's this tool that I'm going to run on my local machine, the Azure Storage Explorer, that lets me upload data into the cloud. This is a tool I would use for if I'm doing practice work, I just want to try things out, or maybe for my one-time initial load of data when I'm first standing up a new cluster. This isn't the tool I'd use for ongoing operational loading of data, day after day, because this isn't automated. Excuse me. But for one-offs, this is a really handy tool. So I'm connected to my ASV storage, and within there, I've got different containers, and in the containers, I'm putting files. And you can see I loaded a CSV file, right? This isn't data necessarily from a database. This just It's a file, and it'll still look like a file when I'm using it on the other side. So then I instantiate my Hadoop cluster, and I'll go over to this Manage Cluster button here. And in the upper corner, I'll click on Setup ASV. And I'm going to tell my Hadoop cluster what's the storage that I'm going to use. So I've given the name of my storage, and there's the key. Please don't write that down. But that's the actual key. I didn't really expect to be doing a screenshot demo. And then once I've done that, I can start to do work in my cluster. So this is actually the remote terminal session onto my Hadoop cluster in the cloud. In the top window there is a little bit of a pig script. And actually, I take that back. They're both parts of a pig script. There's different parts of the script. This is a script that takes my movie data, my movie sales data. It effectively joins, in relational database terms, we'd say it's joining tables together. Now, there are no tables in Hadoop. It's actually joining files together based on the descriptions that I've given it earlier in the script. And what this script is going to do is it's going to take movie sales, it's going to associate the customer information, and then using the currency that was used to buy the videos, it's going to determine whether those are U.S. customers or international customers. And then for U.S. customers, it's going to group them by state. And for international customers, it's going to group them by country. And we're going to roll that up and create a total. But the two kinds of customers have to have different handling because they're aggregating by different fields. And then the whole thing is going to be union all together again at the end. And you can see a lot of the terminology that's in here is really familiar. We've got joins, we've got grouping, we've got union. We should be pretty comfortable with these ideas. The language is a little different than we're used to, but conceptually, we should be pretty comfortable with this. When I run a pig job, it actually is translated into a MapReduce job. Actually, this one's translated into, I think, 5 MapReduce jobs. Yeah. So to execute that script, the system did a translation, wrote 5 MapReduce jobs for me. I didn't write any MapReduce. The system did it. It ran the MapReduce jobs, and it produced a bunch of output. Then also using Pig, I can execute commands that look really Unix-like. For those of you who have used Unix or Linux before, you'll recognize commands like cd and ls and cat. If you've used any of those systems before, you'll be very comfortable using these kinds of commands in Pig. And if I cat the file, which is to list the file, and there's the beginning of it, and you can see that the aggregate data has been produced, and it's in a file. Right? We would normally think of having results put in a table, but in Hadoop, they get put in a file. Now, the other language that I want to mention is Hive. By the way, in Pig, you know, guess what the actual language for Pig is named? Anybody want to hazard a guess? Pig Latin, bingo. All right. In Hive, the name of the language is not quite as colorful. It's HiveQL, Hive Query Language. But you'll notice in Hive Query Language, first of all, it looks really, really a lot like SQL. We're actually defining for Hive the metadata of tables. Well, tables in quotes, because they're really files underneath. We're just describing them so they look like tables. So using that same data set, we've got data on states and users, and you can see that I'm defining the table definition in terms of a file that's out there in the file system in the ASV storage, and I'm saying what the field terminators in that file are, and I'm giving the names and data types for all of the columns. Now that's metadata that Hive is going to remember so that I can come along afterwards and run queries that look, I mean, that's essentially SQL. Select title count of, you know, as purchase count from purchase join media. We give the join key, group by title. We're all very comfortable with writing that sort of thing. And the only thing that's new here is that, not terribly unlike in SQL, I'm gonna drop the table if it exists. I'm gonna create a new table with the output of that query. And just like in Pig, the Hive language gets translated into MapReduce jobs. The upper screen here shows me running the script to execute the MapReduce job. Actually, it's just the tail end of the execution. And then the bottom screen, after that job has been run, I sat down and I said, select star from title counts, limit 20. So at the top 20 rows of the title counts, and there they are on the screen. Again, we write in higher level languages, sometimes languages that look very familiar. It gets translated into MapReduce for us and executed on the system. Okay. So having that brief introduction to two of the tools at least, let's take a minute and think about architecture issues a little bit. And architecture is, of course, a very open-ended term, and different people mean different things, and that's okay. I'm actually going to take some different looks at architecture from different angles so we can think about how we build stuff in this new world. The first thing I want to talk about is the idea that we're used to building OLTP databases and data warehouse databases, and I typically work with data warehousing and business intelligence systems, so I mostly work over on the right-hand side. But we know that you know, ACID databases, which were defined for OLTP operations, they work well for data warehouses, but they're not perfect, are they? As much as we like SQL Server, we like all the tools that it brings, we like all the functionality that it brings, we work around some things that, as large-scale data warehouse guys, we find kind of annoying. So how many of us run with just simple logging on our data warehouses? Yeah? Okay. How many of us drop the indexes on our tables before we load data? See? So what are we doing? We're working around some of the ACID properties. Really? That's really what we're doing. We're taking a tool that was built for an OLTP system, and we're using it very effectively, but we are using it for a different purpose, and we're working around some of the attributes that were built for its original purpose. Now, in the open source community, when they started building Hive, or when they started building Hadoop, I should say, they said, no, let's try not to make that compromise. We'll build Hive as our data warehouse language, and we'll build HBase, or we'll build Cassandra as our OLTP systems. Now, I got to say, what they mean by OLTP is probably different than what we might mean by OLTP. And the difference between ACID and BASE is BASE isn't just an amusing contrast to ACID, for those who have some chemistry background. BASE actually, just like ACID, means something. Atomicity, help me out. Atomicity, consistency, independence, and durability, right? The properties of an OLTP database. BASE means basically available, soft state, and eventually consistent. And there are a different set of properties because what the open source community today means by transaction processing is different. They mean when I click like on something, that that's going to be stored out there and it's going to be remembered. But if I think about this for a minute, when I go to the bank and I deposit $100 in my account, then I walk over to the next ATM, I expect to see that $100, right? I want to know that that's there right away. And under no circumstances should that ever be forgotten, that I deposited that $100. In this more base-like world, when I click like on something, it doesn't really matter if half an hour from now one of my friends looks at their social media page and doesn't yet see my like, right? Obviously, it would be nice if that was there, but the world's not going to end if that hasn't been propagated out there yet. So when they say eventual consistency, that actually means something, right? A transaction can be committed, it can be reliably stored, but just not be represented everywhere yet. It'll eventually get there. So what's meant by OLTP is a little bit different, and you want to think about what kinds of applications you build on which kinds of databases. And Hive, again, that's not a fire alarm, right? That's just a door. I'm going to pause for a second. That would be really annoying to try and talk over. Do we know what's going on? Okay. Yeah, closing the doors might help a lot, yeah. Okay. Okay. This is really impressive. I'm blown away. Sorry. Okay. Well, there's still a windstorm back here, but I think the volume is down enough that we can perhaps continue. We'll try to keep the door closed as much as we can. Okay. That's really great for your train of thought. Pardon? Yeah. Okay, so we'll try to continue. So another way that we might think about architecture is in terms of the properties and expectations of the tools that we're working with. So we know that in the SQL Server world, we've got an ACID database. We've got really a pretty highly evolved set of tools. When you think about, you know, Management Studio and the BI Development Studio and tools like Analysis Services and Reporting Services, there's a pretty highly evolved world. We typically run with enterprise-grade hardware. You know, we use mirrored and RAID storage and all kinds of high availability equipment. And we're used to very efficient execution. Right? SQL Server doesn't waste many cycles running a query. And I think those are in a little bit of contrast to what we should expect when we go to the Hadoop ecosystem. If I think about this from a data warehousing point of view, Hive is a read-only database. We don't do updates to Hive. We can append onto to tables, but if there's data in a table, it's really a file, right? And we don't stick rows in the middle of a file. We rewrite the file. So Hive is really a read-only database. On the other hand, it is massively scalable storage. I can grow my cluster from, you know, the 3-node cluster I've got in my office. I could grow it to 1,000 nodes or, you know, many thousands of nodes. And my ability to store and manipulate data pretty much grows linearly with that. So that's a really nice thing when you're talking about truly big data sets. This is a rapidly evolving ecosystem, right? In the relational world, we're used to, you know, having a solid product, and even when there's a new release, everything that used to work still works. And by gosh, it's the vendor's job to make sure. And as somebody who works for the vendor, I know we'll hear about it if we fail to maintain any compatibility. But in the Hadoop ecosystem, things are changing really fast, and we've already seen that, you know, we take one of the core pieces of Hadoop, HDFS, and we swap it out for something else. We put in a shim and stick ASV in there instead. Wouldn't surprise me if someone's got a new programming paradigm that they want to slip in place of MapReduce sometime. New tools will be coming along. New machine learning tools will be added to the suite. To work in this space, you've got to be paying attention to new developments all the time. Another thing that people like to talk about in the open source community, in fact, there's a lot of hype about this, is the idea that you don't need a schema when you put data into HDFS or into Hadoop in general. And to some degree, that's true. Right? They're just files. You can take any file and you can stick it in HDFS and it's there. But I would argue that there's actually a little more to the picture than that. I think that what we really need to be thinking about is schema on read versus schema on write. This is really a pay me now or pay me later kind of thing. If I just go and stick a bunch of data in flat files out there, and don't think about the organization of that data when I'm putting it in, then I have to think about it when I'm using the data, right? I mean, that data means something. There is a way to interpret that data. And if it's not defined when I put the data in, then I've got to provide an interpretation when I'm using the data. And that's really what Hive and Pig both do, is they provide schema on read interpretations of the data. So let's go back and look at examples of that again. This is very similar to what we looked at in the demo before. This is Hive again. And you can see I'm saying there's a customer file out here. Here's what terminates the fields. Here are the field names and the data types. Now, this is a very simple structure. This again looks very tabular in nature, and the data structures could be richer than that, and we could be doing, you know, user-defined functions to interpret the data. There's all kinds of possibilities, but the point is, in order to use that data, I've got to define what's there. Now at query time, I can go and write my SQL-like queries, and they make sense because I've predefined what the schema looks like. Well, it's not predefined before I put the data in, but it's predefined before I run the queries. And again, I'm actually pretty impressed with what these guys did, at how much that looks like SQL. And if I just walked up to this and didn't know, I actually wouldn't know it was not SQL until I got to here. Whereas we would have said, you know, top 10 in a SQL query, They've got limit TIM. But it would have taken a while to realize what that actually was. In PIG, it's very similar, except that the tool doesn't store the metadata in a persistent way from you know, one instantiation to another. So every time I run a PIG job, I provide a description of the data that I'm going to read, and again, you know, column names and data types, and then further into the job is the actual logic of the thing I want to run. And this one is also a really simple, trivial script. I'm just doing some joins of a couple of files. I'm doing some grouping and aggregation. So it's a really simple little script. But you can see, you know, we define the schema, and then we define the functionality that we're trying to execute. But remember, I got to make sure everybody gets this message. Under the covers, these things are executing MapReduce jobs. Okay, I'm getting the 5-minute notice, so that alarm cost us some time. But it is executing MapReduce jobs. If I think about the enterprise from the point of view of the data warehouse team, this should look really familiar, right? Of course, as a data warehouse guy, I put the data warehouse in the center of the universe, and the OLTP system is over on the side. But data flows through, often through a staging area. We use ETL tools. We sometimes build data marts and cubes. And we've got end users over here who use reports and dashboards and interactive reporting tools. So that should look very familiar. If I look at how this might be structured in a Hadoop context, the picture changes a little bit. A lot of the functionality looks really similar. They use tools like Flume and Scoop to bring data into Hadoop storage. Once it's there, we can run queries using Hive, or if there's an OLTP system to be run, we would use HBase. And it would be built on top of Hadoop storage. PIG might be used as an ETL language to transform data that's in HDFS. Uzi might manage the workflows. I might scoop data out to a presentation database. Now, why is there still a relational database here? I think there's two reasons. One is because all of our tools work well with relational databases. Right? We know how to do reporting off of there. We know how to build OLAP cubes off of there. We know how to connect to things like Excel. And that's one reason. I will say, though, that reason is very rapidly going away because we're building the connectors to let our tools connect directly to Hive storage. But the other reason is that the OLTP database will give much better interactive query performance, right? If I want an answer to a query right now, I'm going to get it from the relational database. I'm not going to get it from Hive. Hive is oriented towards running massive jobs that might take, you know, minutes to hours to run. But if I want a query right now, I want to be working with the relational database in front of that. All right, what's Microsoft doing in this space? I'm really pressed for time, so I'm going to go quickly. I'm not making any announcements. That says 30. We've got extra time. I'm sorry.
Still got plenty of time, but you have 30 minutes to go.
Oh, so the 5-minute one I shouldn't believe? Okay, great. Well, this is not the smoothest execution you've ever seen here, is it? This is proving to be a very confusing session. Okay, so again, I'm not making any announcements, but there's some things you should think about. Microsoft has a partnership with Hortonworks, a very close working relationship with Hortonworks. Hortonworks is a whole bunch of the early developers of Hadoop work at Hortonworks. And what we're doing is we're making sure that Windows is supported as a first-class supported operating system for Hadoop, just like Linux is today. So these changes are being introduced into the Hadoop core, in the code, in the open source community. We're effectively giving all this code back, which means you could, in the future, you'll be able to take any Hadoop, Apache Hadoop distribution and run it on Windows. And that's really crucial. We're not taking our own separate branch. We're going to capitalize on all the energy and momentum of the open source community. But what we are doing are a couple of really interesting things. One is we're making two different distributions of Hadoop. One is a cloud offering, Hadoop on Azure. So you'll be able to, you know, just sign up, get yourself a virtual cluster in the cloud, connect to your cloud storage. You don't have to build any infrastructure yourself. Just tell us how many machines you want. We'll set up the cluster and run that for you. Or you can do Hadoop on Windows, you know, the on-premises distribution. You can run it virtualized or bare metal, you know, on your own site, on your own machines. Whichever environment makes sense for you, we'll support both. And we're the only vendor that can really do that. There's a lot of vendors out there who are rushing into the market, but only from Microsoft can you get both. And then there's some things you just expect from Microsoft. We've heard horror stories about how hard it is to set up a Hadoop cluster in the first place. Well, I can tell you that just 2 or 3 weeks ago, I set up an on-premises cluster on machines in my office, and literally I just like you would expect from Microsoft, I took the installation script, I ran it, I typed in the names of the machines that were going to be part of my cluster, and it set it up and it's ran. I immediately could start loading data and running Pig and Hive jobs. So simple setup, simple management, integration with other management tools. This is what you'd expect from Microsoft. And without announcing anything, I will say that's a reasonable expectation from Microsoft. Also, we've got a really rich stack with SQL Server and the BI tools and the front-end tools. And you would expect Microsoft to offer connectivity to that stack. And absolutely, we will have that functionality. You'll be able to report off of data that's in Hive. You'll be able to build analysis services cubes off of Hive data. You'll be able to connect to Excel and pull data from Hive. So you really benefit from the best of both worlds in a couple of different ways. You benefit from the cloud world and the on-premises world, and you can mix and match all you want. And you benefit from the Hadoop ecosystem and all the tools that it brings to the party and the tools that you already have in your relational world today from Microsoft. You get the best of both. So let's look at another little demo. Could we close the door again, please? Thank you. And now the windstorm comes back. This is really impressive. Okay, so this is Excel. And there's an add-in that you can get off the web. It's called the Hive ODBC connector. And you can see it up there in yellow that I've installed the connector, and it's part of my Excel environment. If I click on that, I get this pane on the right where I can describe the cluster and the data that I want to pull data from. So one of the things it'll want to do is it'll want to know where my cluster is. And I actually apparently snapped this screenshot too early because I hadn't finished typing in the host information. But I would type in something like lenwy.cloudapp.net. That's the name of my cluster out there. And then I'd give my connection information. And now I've got a drop-down list of all the tables, meaning files, that are defined in Hive. and I can pick any of them. I could choose to filter or aggregate the data. In this case, I'm just going to execute the query. I'm just going to pull everything that's in the table. And this is a table that I created using that PIG job before, where I aggregated data by country for foreign customers and for and by state for U.S. customers. And I apologize, that's a very U.S.-centric demo. In fact, we don't even have any Australian customers in the demo database. Obviously, I would have done that differently if I had a choice. But here you can see I've exited the query. Now, just reading data out of Hive and pulling data that's already prepared is really fast. So I just pull the data from Hive. I've got it in Excel. And now I can do things that we know and love about Excel. In particular, I can create pivot tables. Now, I could hook this up with Power Pivot as well. And I didn't do a screen capture of a Power Pivot. But this is just an ordinary Excel table with a pivot table built on top of it. Actually, a pivot chart built on top of it. And then, of course, you know, I can manipulate that a little bit and produce something that will make sense to my business users. And you can see that script that I ran. It aggregated data for our international customers by the countries. For the U.S. customers, it aggregated by states. And now I've got a nice presentation of that data in Excel, which I can, you know, do whatever my business processes need me to do. So just a really quick and dirty demo, but you can imagine doing that with, you know, creating reports off of your Hive tables or building cubes or all kinds of different things. All right. So with that as background, I hope that's a kind of that's a useful overview of this Hadoop ecosystem. Let's talk a little bit about what skills you need to work in this environment. IDC, the big research company, made what I think is actually a pretty safe prediction at the end of last year that said, in 2012, big data will earn its place as the next must-have competency. I don't think they were going out on a limb very far when they wrote that. But if you're in operations, the things that you'll need to be able to do are not all that unlike the things that you need to do already. You need to be able to deploy systems. You need to be able to monitor systems so that you know what's going on. If things fail, you need to be able to repair them. New versions of software, you need to be able to upgrade them, or adding new clusters into your farm. You want to be able to upgrade the hardware. This should all be really familiar. New tool set, but the same, conceptually the same kinds of tasks. You need to think about data stewardship. How do I take care of the data that's been entrusted to me? How do I keep that data secure? And how do I manage the workflows when we bring data into the system and then we do various operations? You know, I can't start my ETL jobs until all the data is available. How do I do those kinds of things? If you're in a more of a business analyst role or a data scientist kind of role, you're doing various kinds of analytics, you're going to want to know tools like HDFS and Hive and PIG. Those are kind of going to be the base level tools on which other kinds of analytics will be built. If you're a statistician, you'll want to know R. But if you're using the more familiar presentation tools that we're used to today, you still want to know Excel, analysis services, reporting services. These don't change that much. We'll connect to a different data source behind it, but those presentation tools will be the same. The thing that will be considerably different is if you're doing data mining today and you want to do machine learning or data mining in the Hadoop ecosystem, you're probably going to be learning Mahout if you want to work in the Hadoop ecosystem. Now, analysis services data mining will still be there. That doesn't change. But if you want to use the new tool set, it's Mahout. Does anybody know what a Mahout is? Pardon? Right, it's the guy that rides the elephant. That would be in like India, not in, it's not an English word, I don't think. At least not my dialect of English. So if you're a developer, some of the basic tooling is going to be the same, right? HDFS, Pig, Hive, the basic underlying tooling. You might want to know some Java for writing MapReduce jobs. Although I will say that if you're using the Microsoft tools, Java will not be the only language that you can use. You'll be able to use C# and others of the really rich languages that you are used to in the Microsoft ecosystem. You probably still want to know how to build analysis services cubes or reporting services reports. If your organization is trying to do machine learning, you'll probably want to use Mahout. Mahout is a very programming-like interface to it. You'll want to know the workflow tools. As a developer, you're probably going to be charged with setting up the systems that get the data in, so you'll want to know Flume and Uzi and things like that. Now, one observation that I'll make is that these tools appear a lot in both columns, right? The developer column and the analytics column. And that is, I think, a byproduct of the fact that these tools came from the open source community. They were made by developers for developers. These tools are, I guess, a developer's dream. Because they give the flexibility, you can change them. You can do stuff. You can make it do what you want. You can program to different interfaces. For those of us who are not developers, I would argue that in some cases these tools are less than a dream. I think in my experience working with Pig, the most common diagnostic that I get is a stack dump. So it's useful to be able to, maybe even if you're not a developer, to be able to at least kind of read and get some idea of what that stuff means. So those are some of the things that I would encourage people to look into for working in this ecosystem. Now, some resources for finding out about this stuff. The first thing to remember is this is open source. It's just out there. It's on the web. It's also at the Apache Hadoop site. So use Bing. find the information on the web. But there are some particular things I want to point you to. Dr. DeWitt from the University of Wisconsin and the Gray Research Lab did a great talk at the PASS conference last year that gave an overview of this Hadoop ecosystem. He really described HDFS and MapReduce way better and way more thoroughly than I did here. So if you're interested in how Hadoop works under the covers, it's a really great talk. The man is a wonderful explainer. Also, the definitive information about Hive and Pig on the Apache website, look for the Hive language manual and the Pig Latin reference manual 2. Be sure to get the one with 2 in it. I made the mistake of using the wrong reference manual for a while, and it was painful. There's some really good books out there. There's a lot of books, and I don't mean to disparage anything by leaving it off the list, but these are some books that people I know about and like. I've used Hadoop, The Definitive Guide. There's another book that a lot of people like, Programming Pig by Ellen Gates. And there's another book that I guess we've seen copies of, but I haven't personally. It releases in just a few days, just a week. Programming Hive is supposed to be a pretty good book. There's commercial training that's available. I would refer people to Hortonworks University. Hortonworks is really one of the two companies with by far the most expertise in the Hadoop space. And there's a couple of third-party analytical tools that can be very helpful. If you are a data analyst or a business analyst, you might think about looking at KarmaSphere and Datamere. These can be pretty useful tools. Okay, so at the end of all this, there's kind of been a bunch of messages in this talk. Some of them might sound like mixed messages, right? It's a confusing thing to keep track of all that's going on here. This stuff is still evolving. But man, can you deal with a lot of data in this environment? If you've got a big data problem, this is a really useful set of tools. And it's exciting to get involved in something new. And from a career point of view, and from the point of view of the companies we all work for, it's a big opportunity to do new things that really weren't easily doable before. Yeah, things aren't perfect, but it's really interesting. And I'd encourage you to take a look at these tools if you've got data that is in that realm of big data. You've got, you know, sensor-generated data, you've got automatically generated data, or you've got new data types that don't fit in relational databases. It's a big opportunity to do new things and for our companies to offer new kinds of services. And with that, I'd like everybody to have their opportunity to win this mouse. But even more importantly, I'd like your feedback. I do read the feedback from these sessions. I'd like to do better every time I present, no matter how confusing and distracting the environment is. So please, feel free to give me your feedback. I will read it, especially the written comments. I will read every one of those. And maybe future audiences will get benefit from your experience. So thank you for your time. I hope this has been useful, and I will stick around and answer questions as long as I'm not interfering with the next speaker. At that point, we'll take it out into the hallway. So thanks very much. Hi there.
You said two things that seem to contradict, so I would like that clarified, which was,
okay.
One was the relational database is still there because it's fast for